You are listening to a burst.co.uk production for Radio Wimborne. Sci-fi and fantasy Sunday at the Wimborne Literary Festival saw the coming together of three well-known writers in the genre. Mitch Benn is known for his stand-up comedy and radio work, alongside his writing. He has recently released Terror's World, the sequel to the critically acclaimed sci-fi novel, Terror. Ben Aronovich has written for Doctor Who and is the author of the best-selling series Rivers of London. Suzanne McLeod, a local writer, has penned the fantasy series Spellcrackers.com and chaired this event, which took place at the Allendale Centre in Wimborne on the 9th of November. Oliver Morris caught up with Suzanne to hear about her work.
So I'm sitting here with
Suzanne McLeod, author of the Spellcrackers.com series, which is set in London, features Genevieve Taylor, who is a she-fae, a fairy, and her job is to make magic safe. All my supernatural characters are recognisable in the myths, in that my fairies are Celtic fairies, so they're not the nice twee little winged ones. They tend to be sort of normal sized or human sized. They can be shape changers. They're the sort of fairies that you don't want to upset and make angry, because they're quite capricious and tricky, and one minute they might like you and the next minute they might turn you into somebody with an ass's head. But also I've always been interested in fairies and folklore and mythology, and so I have a sort of a mild knowledge, or a vague knowledge of fairies. And then as I started to write about them and the fae, I started to delve a lot more into the stories about them, and to read different stories written about fae, and then basically mix up my own mythology for my own characters. I'm quite lucky in that in my non-writing life I'm self-employed, so I can sort of manage my time as I want to. It's the old adage that the more time you have, the more the job expands to fulfill that time. But no, I try and write every day when I'm not hound wrangling. And basically the more you write every day, the easier it becomes and the quicker the story goes down, even if you don't write an awful lot. When you write your first book, it's always a little bit sort of daunting, because this is the first book and is it any good, and how are you going to go about it? But I think once you've written more than one and you've written some short stories and you get into the hang of writing, then I think it's a little bit like driving. You get into forgetting about the how to change gear or how to construct sentences, and you start thinking more about the story and how to get the story down in the best way, so that the story has the impact that you want it to. I do have a character that I killed off. I'm not saying where, but I killed off a character, and I never planned to kill this character off, but the story called for this character to be killed off, which was really sad, because in my mind I had a whole future for this character planned out, and a short story, and she was going, I say, and this character was going to do things, but then unfortunately this character had to die. Oh. I would like to stop time so that I could have the 48 hours in the 24 hours, but then obviously, like all superpowers, there would probably be some kickback from that, so I'd hate to think what that would be. You'd probably age faster than everybody else or something. Failing that, either the flying, or rather than a superpower, just a transporter, so you can go from A to B in a flash.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the final event of the Wimborne's wonderful Literary Festival. Yes. Fantastic. And we thought this year we'd do some science fiction and fantasy. One of the reasons I love it, it's a great seller at Gulliver's Bookshop, 47 High Street, Wimborne. All right, okay. Thank you, guys. And so it was great to be able to bring you three really, really super great writers that we love to have on our shelves. So I hand you over now to Suzanne McLeod, Mitch Benn and Ben Aronovich. Thank you.
Right, we're going to start. Is there a certain type of scene that's harder for you to write than others?
Yeah, it's the ones that haven't really swum into focus yet.
I don't know if this is how it's done or whether this is how it's absolutely not done, but my first book in particular, the second book less so, but my first book in particular, I just wrote completely out of sequence. Because I kind of had it in my head as a series of events. And just to keep the thing moving, just to keep the project moving, because I've got a lot of demands on my time. You know, I do stand-up comedy, I'm a songwriter, I tour on my own and with my band, I do that thing on the radio, I've got two small children. You know, I was basically writing in short bursts of activity as and whenever the opportunity presented itself. So you don't really spend too much time agonizing about, how do I keep the narrative flow going at this point? It's just any bit that I had in my head clear, and then I thought, right, write that. And one of the joys of everything being electronic these days, of it all being on computers, laptops and everything, is that you can write it completely out of sequence. And if a bit that you then subsequently write, which happens before the bit you've already written, has some effect on the bit you've already written, it's relatively simple to change that bit you've already written to accommodate what you've just written. You know, it would have been bloody nightmare trying to do that with pen and paper or even typewriters, you know. So, but as it goes, is there a particular kind of scene? It's difficult because I've only written the two books so far. I mean, one of the two books I'm working on now is very, very different. I'm working on Terror 3. Which I'm not entirely sure what I'm going to call it yet, so I'm not going to give the title yet. Terror's World, and it's Terror's something else, but, you know. The other one I'm writing at the moment, which I don't want to give too much away, is a kind of a future dystopia thing, but there's a lot of military involvement in it. It's a very, 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 it's a completely different kind of space to get your head in, you know what I mean? And actually, one thing which I'm slightly in awe of Ben and anybody else who writes kind of cop books, is the level of research. I've just completely cheated with my first two books and set them entirely on a fictitious planet. So I'm, you know, I don't need, I have no technical advisor. That planet works exactly how I says it, how I say it does. But you know, I was talking about this with Ian Rankin, you know, but you know, because how much research do you have to do? Because if you're writing something entirely based around, you know, Edinburgh and Lothian police, how much about that do you actually need to know? Do you need to get it right? And he said, well, it was a real annoyance because they closed down the station where Rebus was based and completely reorganised the whole of South Edinburgh Police. And he said he had to read up on it all again to get it all right. But fortunately, it was the book where Rebus comes out of retirement, so it was all new to him as well. You know what I mean? But I mean, I find that slightly daunting. So the book I'm writing at the moment has got a lot of, you know, it's based in and around the military, so I'm having about which I know literally nothing. So that's something I'm having to do. You know, I find that a bit more daunting. Something you could actually get wrong. When you're operating entirely within the confines of your own imagination, you can't actually get anything wrong. It could be bad, but it can't actually be incorrect. You know what I mean? So something you can get wrong, I find quite daunting.
Ben, how about you? Any certain times of scenes that might be harder for you to write than others?
Yeah, well, it's the same. Scenes that haven't come into focus. I mean, that you often go, like, you sit down and you go, ah, this is going really well, I'm going to do 1,000 words today, and then you just kind of go, bong! And you're thinking, I was doing so well 3 seconds ago, what the hell happened? And usually what's happened is you've transitioned from one thing that you absolutely knew everything about how that was going to go, and you then kind of, like, you run straight into a scene where you haven't got the faintest, really, idea, and you're kind of feeling your way through it. And that can be very frustrating, and like Mitch says, one of the things you can do is you can go on and then write the next scene. What happens with me is I tend to start at the beginning and then there's sort of like things get thrown out, so I'm writing bits from that and bits from that, and then slowly I kind of like write at the bits that kind of join up, and then yeah, more things get thrown out further up along the line, and then I kind of write like that, and then I have to edit it because it's usually weird. And but yes, scenes I haven't really got a focus on. In terms of types of scene, some scenes are I'm always a bit cautious about sex scenes, because ever since my son started reading my books, there's always that kind of little niggle at the back of your head. Your son's going to read this. Be very careful about what you put in.
I haven't run into that yet. There hasn't been any of mine yet. But I remember there's that lovely quote from Neil Gaiman that time. Yeah, I've often thought it would be nice to write porn, but every time I tried, imaginary parents would appear at my shoulder. And by the time I was old enough to make the imaginary parents go away, actual children would appear at my shoulder.
That's so true.
So, staying with scenes then, Ben, what about, have you got a favourite scene that you've written in any of your books?
You usually have one of, I mean, most writers I know have a favourite scene from each of their books, and it's usually something that nobody else notices, that they think's really clever, and they you read the reviews thinking someone's bound to notice how clever and intelligent and wonderfully subtle that scene was, and no one ever does, and so I'm loath to tell anyone.
Well, no, first book, favourite scene in the first book.
Favourite scene in the first book. That's not so easy, just to talk off the top of the head. My favourite scene in the first book is I Can Do Magic, I have to say. Right? That's my absolute favourite scene, where he just does it for the first time and goes,
Mitch.
Right, okay. I'm going to work in the assumption that very few people have actually read it other than mine. There's a bit in the first one where I basically take an entire chapter out to just sketch in a bit of background for the three main characters. I just basically spend one night with the three. The idea of my books is a human baby is inadvertently abducted by aliens and is adopted and grows up on another planet. So it's a human child living on another world. And there's just one chapter in the first book. I just basically take the entire chapter out to show what these three kids do when they're left to their own advices. This one human child and these two alien children, they have things that they do that are nobody else's business. And I just spend an entire chapter with them. And it doesn't actually move the plot on at all, but I think it makes everything which else happens in the book make a lot more sense. And when I got to the end of that, I thought, wow, that feels quite, because this is my first novel, that feels quite confident to just literally step off the gas for an entire chapter and go, this is what we're talking about. This is just a bit of detail for the people that we're going to spend the rest of this book with. As regards the second book, the second book's hard to talk about because I rather stupidly put a twist at the beginning. There's a twist at the beginning of the second book which makes it kind of difficult to discuss it in too much detail. But the reveal of that twist is one of my favourite things I've ever written. I say, if you don't punch the air at the end of chapter 1.4, then this book isn't going to work for you. But there's also what I'm quite impressed with, again, because I'm interested, because I'm very new to this. I've only written the two books so far. And I'm interested in kind of charting my own progress as a writer to my own satisfaction. Just, you know, and something I was quite pleased about is the second book doesn't end how I thought it was going to. The events are much as I'd anticipated, but the characters' responses to them are not what I thought they were going to be until I actually came to write that bit. And I thought, no, that's not how you feel, is it? That's not how we feel about this. So tonally, the end of book two is completely different to what I thought it was going to be. And I remember thinking, I think that's a little step forward as a writer, because the characters are now so defined in my head that they're kind of dictating their reactions to me.
Bloody character.
You know? I think it's good. I mean, I remember reading, I'm sure you've read that, this is the axiom somewhere, that, you know, good characters will get you through bad plot in a way that good plot will not get you through bad characters. And something I've begun to realise, I think we've had this conversation already, is that actually once you start, if you're doing it right, they should be kind of all the same thing. Because all plot is people doing stuff. And what they do is determined by the kind of person they are. And determined to their, you know, how they, even when you have like a plot with an unconscious agent, like a disaster movie or something, the plot is people's reactions to the situation. So if the characters work, the plot doesn't exactly take care of itself, but it kind of defines itself. And so I was quite pleasantly surprised to discover that book two, the ending, dictated itself to me rather than, because there's nothing I like worse than in a book or movie or something when the characters do something that they just absolutely would not do, but it's what the story wants, it's what the plot wants, you know, everything everybody does in Love Actually. That entire film, all people do is stuff they literally would never do, but it's what the movie needs. Star Wars prequels. There is no reason for the princess to fall in love with Anakin, because he's a whiny little bitch. And he's just the least appealing character in science fiction history. But she's going to have to fall in love with him because, you know, we know that she does. Yeah, but she wouldn't, but she's going to have to. You know, and nothing to my mind sticks out and really throws me out of a narrative as when characters just do things that the story requires them to do that they just wouldn't do, you know. Anyway. So.
Yes,
I'm with you.
I agree.
On that point.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
I think going back to characters, obviously. Ben, your books have got Peter Grant as your main character. You've got some pretty strong secondary characters. But Where did Peter come from himself?
Ah, well, yeah. Ah, Peter. That's difficult. That's quite difficult because there's... I assume everyone's got this, but in a writer, it's a particular kind of resource. It's this kind of reservoir of stuff that kind of exists in the back of your head where you get, like, you're just idly walking along and you have an idea and you go, oh, that's quite a good idea, and you stuff it into the sack and you stuff it into the sack, and these kind of things all kind of mix up, and every so often things climb out of the sack and go, oi, I'm here and I'm a good idea, you should use me. And Peter was one of those. He just kind of climbed out of my subconscious one day and said, hello, my name's Peter Grant and I am member of that mighty army for justice known as the Metropolitan Police to all right-thinking people, and the filth to everybody else. And as soon as, you know, I had that line literally came into my head, and I knew who his father was, I knew which estate he grew up, I knew which school he went to. Everything about him suddenly just kind of popped into my head. And I just thought, I'm having you. Quick, get on the page. and that was it. And that, literally, that's when I started writing the novel. I had that. I really had nothing else at that point.
So then you had to work your murders out?
Yeah, sort of. I went quite a long way before I worked out the murders. I knew there had to be a murder, because it's a murder mystery, but, you know.
Yeah, it does help,
Kate. It helps because I'm not interested in the criminals. See, there are basically two types of crime writers. There's the ones that are really interested in the cops, and they're the ones that are really interested in the criminals. And I'm not interested in the criminals. They're just kind of like a good excuse for a lot of procedurals. So, I mean, it's a terrible thing to say. But some people really like them. You know, you read, like, Ruth Rendell. She's obviously really into the psychology of why people commit murder and everything. And I'm really interested in how they get caught. Because that's just the way my brain is wired. And so, therefore, it's not so important. The actual murders, the actual psychology of the people doing the murdering is not so important to me as the psychology of the people doing the catching. And so, therefore, once I have my cop, I'm good to go. You know, I'm good to go. Once I have a cop and I have a settlement, I have a puzzle, I'm good to go. I don't need to worry about whether the other one had an unhappy childhood or something.
Would you ever think about flipping it around? Because I'd be very tempted, if I were writing something like the Peter Grant books or something like the Rebus books or something, to flip it around one time and have him as a sort of a background character.
I
you know
actually,
what I mean? And tell it from the point of view of the bad guy and have him just like on the horizon coming to get the bad guy. Have him as the antagonist. You know what I mean? I'd be very tempted to do that.
I have thought.
Never understood why Conan Doyle didn't write one book from Moriarty's point of view. I know Horowitz has just done that. But you know what I mean? I would have been so tempted, you know. So I think Fleming did it, didn't he? Fleming did a couple of books in which Bond is basically a peripheral character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of doing that. I'm thinking of doing that in the because there is going to be a comic.
Right.
You see, and that's very good because, I'm not restricted by the first-person narrative in that
one. Right,
And so in a comic, I can start looking at it from multiple point of views. And so that's actually quite a good comic book arc to do it from that point of view.
I'm always very scared of the first-person. Lee Child cheats. He jumps in and out of it. Some of the reaches are first-person and some of them aren't.
I
find that really bewildering, actually. You go from one to the next. Oh, we're back inside his head for this one. Oh, we're going to get that. Yeah.
I think part of the appeal of the books is so much Peter Grant's voice, though.
Right, yes.
Yeah, so therefore, if you ain't broke, don't fix it. Yeah. That's my attitude on that one. I used to write in a tight third person. I like a tight third person.
Yeah.
And I don't like omniscient. The reason why I don't like the 19th century authors very much is because they have this kind of omniscient narrator who goes, and this is how young men behaved in 2094, and you think, shut up.
Well, one thing you get all of in the 19th century is the, I can never pronounce it, epistolary novel.
Yes,
the letters. Everything's written as, you know, Dracula is.
Yes.
All letters and diary entries. That was a big thing in the 19th century.
And recordings on wax cylinders.
Yes.
State of the art.
Dr. Seward's wax cylinder, yes.
Yeah. Your books start off with the lovely twist of a baby being abducted by the alien and then obviously totally destroying the usual trope of horrible things happening to the baby.
Yeah.
It's a very nice alien.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. He's very well meaning, just slightly inept alien. Everybody complains about the fact that the alien language in my book has no vowels. That's what people have said. And that wasn't just a sneaky thing to make everybody buy the audiobook to find out how you're meant to pronounce half the book. I don't regard my alien pronunciations as definitive. If anybody's come up with a way of saying these words, it's good to them. That's fine. But it does actually become a plot point that the alien language has no vowels. It's only when you get to the end of the first book you realise that the alien language having no vowels is actually germane to the story, but yes, Lubbock, yes.
So what was the name of the game? I always like the name of the game.
Oh, Gushketh.
Yes.
Well, there's two games. Gushketh is the sport, because they're a bit sport obsessed, and there's a bunch of games mentioned. But Gushketh is kind of partly a tribute to Mornington Crescent and partly a take of Quidditch, I'll admit that. Because the thing about Gushketh is I never explain it.
No, I love that.
The more you hear about it, the less sense it makes.
And that's
kind of inspired by Mornington Crescent. You know Mornington Crescent, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. That the more you hear it played, the less sense it makes. That, you know, it just sounds like there's a game in there somewhere. So the idea of Gushketh is I never explain how it works. And the more information you get about it, the more you know, what the hell's going on? I thought it was quite admirable the way that JK actually worked out Quidditch to the nth degree and actually explains literally how this game, which couldn't possibly ever actually exist, were because it requires sentient balls and flying broomsticks. You know what I mean? And I thought that was quite fun. I thought, let's not do that. let's have this completely inexplicable game. So,
I didn't yes. Know that game.
Where did the idea of the baby come from?
The fact that it's an alien abduction is kind of incidental. I was thinking of that as one of the eternal tropes. The transplanted child. You know, the baby lost or removed from its home environment and growing up in an extraordinary environment with hilarious and or rip-snorting consequences. You know, this goes all the way back at least as far as Moses, and anybody with a proper classical education could probably tell you what was being plagiarised there. And then it goes all the way through literature and pop culture. You know, Jungle Book and Tarzan, same story. Superman. Will Ferrell's Elf. Neil wrote one, The Graveyard Book. And in fact, even the title of The Graveyard Book is an obvious nod to Kipling, isn't it? You know what I mean? Human baby lost in the jungle, raised by the beast. Human baby lost in the graveyard, raised by the ghosts. You know, and I was thinking about this trope. You know, what is that as sci-fi? What's the sci-fi spin on that? And suddenly thought, human baby abducted by a UFO grows up on another planet. Why has nobody written that? So I had a quick Google. This is a conversation Ben and I had a few times. So I had a quick Google to see if anybody had written that. And to the best of my knowledge, nobody had written that story. Ben's pointed out to me, I was... there is one story which has a similar-ish idea, which is about an alien race that clone a human and raise it as their own because one day it will be the emissary to go and make peace with the human race. What's it called? Cuckoo's Nest?
Cuckoo's Eggs.
Cuckoo's Egg, yeah. But I had a bit of a Google, but my idea of a baby being abducted from Earth. But it's just, I thought the idea of also, you know, alien abductions, you know, are the aliens evil? Are the aliens benign? How about the aliens are just well-intentioned but a bit rubbish? Which I think is something I've almost certainly Nick from Douglas Adams. The through line which goes all the way through the Hitchhiker's thing is the idea that rubbishness is universal. The idea that because aliens are infinitely more advanced than us doesn't mean that they're not any cleverer than us. You know, it doesn't actually make them smarter or better than us. You know, so it's the idea that, you know, you have petty bureaucratic aliens or egomaniac aliens or sort of massively insecure aliens. The idea that aliens are every bit as, you know, or that the crapulence of the human race is reproduced in every species of the galaxy. So it's a slightly sort of a less withering take on the same idea. The idea that just because they've got more advanced technology, that doesn't actually necessarily mean they're better. And that actually becomes the theme of the book. Just because you're more advanced, it doesn't necessarily make you better. You know, which I suppose goes all the way back to H.G. Wells, you know, and it's more advanced does not equal superior, you know, either emotionally or intellectually, you know.
So with the, obviously yours is on an alien world.
Yeah.
Your Peter Grant books are set in London, mostly, although you're going out of London.
Herefordshire.
So
most remote place I could find.
Not quite. Close to London, maybe.
It's very remote.
Well, it's not.
It's very remote without being in Wales.
Or Scotland.
That's not so much the Outer Hebrides.
If you take a London character and you stick them in Scotland, then you got the whole Scottish thing, and if you put them in the north, then you got the whole north thing, and then if you put them in the southwest, you've got the whole Cornwall thing.
So Herefordshire's the most distant place that doesn't have a distinct regional identity.
Well, it has a very distinct regional identity, but it doesn't have that kind of like southern git.
Right, gotcha, fair enough. Okay, yeah.
But going, you know, they don't necessarily regard London. Well, actually, they do regard London as the source of all evil. It's just Peter just finds amusing, generally.
So, why move out of London then?
Oh, because if you've written four books, with a character who loves London, lives in London, and has grown up in London, you have to take them out of London at some point and stick them somewhere that's out of their comfort zone. And I always had planned to have a story outside, because I wanted to go out to the countryside to, so that people wouldn't go, oh, you said all your stuff in London, you London person. So I wanted to set him, and I wanted to set him in the countryside, and I wanted it to be very, very countryside. And Herefordshire is, if you got it, I don't know how many people have been to Herefordshire.
I've been everywhere, yeah, man.
Herefordshire is exactly how you imagine Tolkien imagined the English countryside to be. Yeah. It's just what it looks like. It's rolling hills and huge hedgerows and nestled farms and villages and well, a couple of nasty kind of 60s castle flat buildings. Yeah. But it's exactly, you know, and half-timbered, you know, proper 16th century half-timbered houses and stuff like that. You know, it's the kind of place where you expect people to be wearing smocks and have straw coming out of their lips. They don't, of course. They all drive Land Rovers and take dope, as far as I can tell. Extraordinary amount of marijuana smoking in Herefordshire.
But I feel that geographical identification is something I've never really had. You know what I mean? Another good reason to say everything. What's that?
The opening of Terror's World in Liverpool, I noticed.
It's kind of suggested that it might be in Liverpool, and certainly the protagonist that I introduced for the second book is very much based on a teenage me. It's never actually explained. When I do it on the audio book, I made him Scouse, because, you know, people don't do that voice in audio books ever. And it's that sort of slightly whiny Scouse as well, you know, that sort of slightly self-pitying, sort of scaredy sound. It's kind of the closest thing you can do in an English accent to the Shaggy voice, you know what I mean? Like, wow, Scoob! You know what I mean? So that's why I made him that sort of slightly trepidatious sounding Scouse, you know what I mean? And also because there's a character in the second book called Billy Dolphin who is entirely the 14-year-old me, so I mean, it just kind of made sense to make them Scouse, you know. But geographically, Terry's a bit vague. I mean, it's kind of suggested that her and her family are actually from America, although they've definitely been transplanted to somewhere in Britain.
I definitely thought they were in America in the first place.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why we were suddenly in Liverpool. I went, hold on.
Yeah, and that was, you know, again, part of also writing the first book slightly out of order is I actually wrote the ending of book one first. It's one of the first things I wrote. that's something I've thought would be, I slightly envy people who've got that sort of real geographical identification with somewhere, you know what I mean? It's something they've really been able to muster up. Maybe I'll just have to invent somewhere.
Well, I mean,
like Gotham, just have my own fictitious city that I know into that. You know?
Well, that's what I mean. One of the things that the people talk about when they talk about the difference between crime and science fiction and fantasy, and they go, oh, you write fantasy that's also crime, that's so weird. But if you think about something like the 87th Precinct,
yeah.
No, if you read the essay by Ed McBain about how he came to create the 87th Precinct,
yeah.
It's because he kept on phoning up the New York police. He originally set them in New York, and he kept on phoning up the New York police asking, but what happens if this? And this is like the 1950s. So this is like a proper phone on the other end of a policeman is angrily at the other end of your phoning up asking them, you know, what's the procedure for putting a perp down to the station at this point? And he suddenly thought, if I make up my own city, I won't have to keep phoning the New York cops and they'll stop shouting at me. And so he created it. And I think the city in Isola and Diamondback and all these places that are like trip off my tongue so easily.
Yeah.
Is as much an act of secondary creation, as they call it, as Middle Earth or any other.
This is a conversation we've had again. You do sometimes run into people who just literally can't handle sci-fi and fantasy on any level. And what actually formed me a weird little insight is one time I was talking to Neil Gaiman about something, and there was somebody else, I can't remember who it was. And this, in the course of conversation, this person who we were talking to said that she didn't believe in ghosts, and then turned to Neil and said, sorry. And Neil and I looked at each other, you know. And we sort of thought, maybe, do you think it's because there are some people who are so incapable of basically committing themselves to any narrative that isn't set in what is apparently the real world? They think that the only reason some people can is that we think it's all true. You know what I mean? And I just thought that was really, really bizarre. And that's something I've often pointed out. That's the, I don't mind at all if people don't like science fiction. It only winds me up when people say they don't like science fiction because it's all made up. I'm like, yeah, that's what fiction means. That's kind of implicit in the fiction bit. The science has really no bearing on this. And all those other stories that people are so enraptured by that they think happening in the real world, they're all made up too. You know what I mean? Walford is every bit as made up as Westeros.
I love Walford. You know what I mean? I love Walford for that, yeah, for that,
yeah,
matter.
Yeah, exactly. Downton Abbey doesn't exist in the real world any more than bloody, you know, Isengard. You know what I mean?
When I was writing Casualty, I wrote one Casualty a very long time ago, before it was fashionable. Just after writing Doctor Who, before it was fashionable. Ooh. I do a lot of things before they're fashionable. I wrote Casualty, and I think the lady who was writing the thing before me, she had a football match. It was going to be like a football match, and I'm writing Casualties, obviously. And yeah. It was Holby City, and she said, well, who should they be playing? And I said, oh, they should be playing Walford.
Yeah.
Yes. And the producer was a very humorless man called Peter Norris. So I said, no, Walford's made up. And I thought, you are a humorless man, and I know what.
You've been Melchester Rovers,
shouldn't
you? Melchester Rovers, they're the best, the most famous fictitious football team.
Well, oh yeah, well, is there a Coronation Street football team? They should be them, that's what I reckon.
What's the fictitious bit of Manchester Curry saying?
I don't know. I don't watch Curry.
What's that? Weatherfield. Yeah.
Weatherfield.
The fictitious bit of Manchester that Curry's sitting. Yeah, exactly. But this is it, you know. And it's so weird that people find it hard to make that extra leap, that, like, you know, you're watching made up narratives involving made up people. All we're going is one step further, made up narratives involving made up people in a made up environment. That's all it is. Or an environment that admits to being made up and isn't a sort of slightly facile facsimile
it's
of a real world.
It's not real the way Trollope is.
What's that?
Barchester and
what is it? You know, Wessex.
Yes. Casterbridge.
Yeah, Casterbridge. You know, this is it. You know, these places are all made up. You know, but it's this idea that something, you know, oh yeah, but it's a made up fake real place rather than a made up place. You know what I mean? It's, I don't know. But I've never really got that.
We can do this for hours, by the way.
Oh, we really could. Yeah. She's got all kinds of questions that aren't even going to ask.
Well, I thought I'd write a few questions down, all right, just in case you might actually, you know,
stop, pause for breath. So, yeah. Yes.
What's a typical working day like for you, Mitch?
For me, oh God.
Should we stick to the writing and then?
Well, I mean, if I'm getting to stick to the writing, then yeah, but I almost never do.
No.
Because the demands on my time are so varied and so random. See, part of the difficulty is I don't really have an average day because I still gig 3 or 4 days a week. Either I've been touring the show I did at Edinburgh last year about the Beatles. Next year I'm going to be touring the show I did at Edinburgh this year, and I'm still playing comedy clubs on and off, and they're of course in completely random locations. So some days I'll be waking up in a B&B in Middlesbrough, you know, or I'll have to leave the house at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon to drive to Leeds, or you know, so it is very, very random. What I actually had to do to answer the question in a slightly roundabout way is a lot of the first two books were written in furious bursts of energy, having basically sequestered myself in this barn in the Peak District, which was something which dawned on me as a matter of necessity when we finally signed the deal for the first one. Because the story of how I got signed up to write the first two books by Gallant's it's become a sort of little legend. I got signed up over Twitter. Long story. Anyway, when we finally signed the deal, it was like Christmas 2011, and the first manuscript for the first book had to be delivered on April the 1st, 2012. And I was going to be touring with my band for the whole of February and March and doing the Now Show on the radio. So basically I had like this 2 week window in the back half of January. I'd already written about half of it, but I had about this 2 week window in the back half of January to get this book finished. And I said to my wife, Clara, does your uncle still own that barn in the middle of nowhere in the Peak District? She said, yes. Yeah. Do you think he'd lend it to me for 2 weeks? Because the only way this is getting done is if you just literally got to do it like Stephen King does it. Wake up, fix coffee, start typing. Type until eyes glaze over, go to bed, repeat. You know what I mean? This is the only way we're going to get this thing done. So it varies entirely between me literally, you know, writing a single paragraph on my phone on the bus, which I would do occasionally, just write it on my phone and save it and email it to myself and incorporate it into the manuscript. Or when we're getting serious about it, I literally go off, and it's like James Caan in Misery, basically go off to the barn in the hills. And I did actually get snowed in one time as well, and I was thinking, I've seen this movie. driving away from the barn through the snow-covered hills, had this horrible feeling, I'm going to wake up in a scary old house with a lady with a sledgehammer. But it, but it was... But yeah, so it varies mildly between being completely dilettante and just getting the odd paragraph sometimes to being absolutely monkishly committed to the whole thing and just hiding out until it's done, you know. And I'll probably have to do that again with the third book at some point, you know, just have to go up and hide in the hills. Don't know when though, because the Bloody Now show starts again the week after Christmas. That's not going to happen. Anyway.
What about you, Ben?
Well, mine's gradually changed due to the fact that my son has got older. So when I first started, I had a full-time job, and my son, who was like also a full-time job, and actually they say when you start writing, if you start writing, you generally have to give up something, and I gave up my social life because I had, you couldn't give up the job, and I couldn't give up my son.
See, I was smart enough never to develop one.
See, so well, you know,
I saw that coming. Yeah.
You can keep it in the house; it's always good. So what happened was I got up very early in the morning because I worked in a bookshop, and as booksellers will tell you, after you've done kind of 8 hours of bookselling, there is no way in hell you're going to write anything, because all you want to do is go to bed. No books, get them away from me. So I used to get up at sort of like 6 o'clock in the morning. Unfortunately, my son used to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and then come in and annoy me. So I used to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I got into the habit of getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I got stuck in this habit now. When I'm writing, especially in the summer when it's light, of getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and that way I can get a good 2 hours of procrastination in before I have to get down. So basically, I roll out of bed and I get some coffee, and I take my blood pressure medication with the coffee, which is probably not a good thing. While I'm doing that, the computer is booting up, and of course I get down and I sit down and I check Twitter and emails, and if anyone's said anything about me on the internet ever, very useful name, Aronovich, for checking, for ego surfing. See, because either me or my brother.
So yes, you or Dave, isn't it, basically, yes.
So I have to just put Ben in, you see, and I screen out my brother. And then I do some research, and then usually about 7 or 8, I start writing. And effectively, if I haven't done 500 to 600 words by about 1 o'clock, it's not going to get done. It's taken me a long time to work this out, basically. I keep going, I'll do it after lunch. No, it doesn't happen. After lunch, I have a nap. Well, I got up at 5, remember. So I have a nap, and then I have something to eat, and then I go back to the computer, and I either like watch stuff, or I go into my living room, which I can do now, because my son's gone to university, and I've got my living room back, and my nice big TV, and I can find my Blu-rays, and there's no longer things scattered on the floor. So before it was like, if the phone rang, it was like, oh, tiptoeing through the tulips, get to the phone. But now I can just walk to the phone, so it's much easier to contact before the phone goes to the answer phone. And so, yeah, so that's my day. I don't have a life really apart from writing. I do that for about 99% of my life, and then the other 1% is spent here in places like this, telling people that I don't have a life. Which is good, because this is actually my life, I suppose. So there you go.
You mentioned research.
Yay.
So there is another percent of your life where you go off and do research.
Well, it looks a lot like procrastination a lot of the time, my research. Because it involves doing things I like. Oh, I'm going to read up about the police. Gosh, that's hard work. I also, you know, I go and look at the various locations. Because you don't have an excuse if you actually live in the city you're writing about. So you can't go, I will go for one day and go to all these places. You think, all right, come on, Garden, I shall go down and have a look. And I do walk out, if I do chases and stuff, I do kind of try and work out what's possible. Like in Moon Over Soho, there's a chase through the Trocadero Centre, which no longer exists, because they decided to tear it down after I sort of chased there. And I walked through that.
You should have just demolished it in the book.
I was tempted.
Yeah.
I was tempted, but he'd already done that in the other book, and I thought I didn't want to repeat myself. And I also knew that Sky Garden was going to come down at some point, you see. So, I hope it's not a spoiler. And you do that research. And then I also have my police contacts, and I go and badger various organisations. Some organisations are really hard to get hold of. Like the police, they're so helpful. They'll talk to you about anything. But like the bloody Environment Agency, it's like trying to talk to quicksand. Like, oh yes, why do you want to know? Well, I'm a writer. Yes, but I'm not sure I understand why you want to know. Tell me about the River Lug, for God's sake. How complicated is the River Lug that you can't find me someone who knows about, you know? And I spent 6 months trying to get an expert on the River Lug to talk to me from the Environment Agency, and I couldn't get one. They would say, write it. So I wrote like a 5-page essay, which for me is a lot of work. You know, that was like 5 weeks' work, this 5-page essay on why I wanted to know about the River Lug. And I never got a response. So the Environment Agency are about to have horrible things happen to them. I tend to take my revenge. You can always tell which organisations have been nice to me and which haven't by whether...
Who,
you
gets
know,
eaten by slugs.
Yes,
and
who gets eaten by slugs. Who gets devoured. Who's written off as incompetent, you know, idiots. So Thames Water are not going to have a happy time. Because they're also... Thames Water's attitude is different, right? Yeah. They're a big,
best of luck flushing your toilet, mate.
They're a big privatised company, and so they, when you phone up there, they've always had the most rudest... I don't know if he's still there, but when I first started writing, they were famous for having the rudest PR people. And you'd phone up and say, can I talk to you about your... No! Why do you want to know? Like, literally like that. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. You go, why do you want to know? And you'd go, well, I was thinking of writing... Why is that good enough? So, I don't know. They might be nice to me this time. I haven't contacted them. I'm a bit scared of them, to be honest.
So, Mitch, you obviously didn't, or maybe you did, go to... What? Another planet to do your research.
No, I did not. No.
So how?
I don't think so. They can wipe your memory. And
Terror is classed as science fiction.
Yeah.
Is the science? Did you research your science, or did you just decide to go for the sort of more Star Trek option?
I did a kind of a little seminar on this at the Hammond High Literary Festival in London about sort of sci-fi science. I think, to my mind, the thing which denotes science fiction, and this is why, oddly enough, I take issue with Billy Dolphin, and I think Star Wars still counts. So the big debate is Star Wars sci-fi, or is it just basically actually high fantasy with lasers? And I say, well, the very presence of lasers kind of at least quasi-qualifies it as sci-fi. To my mind, what qualifies something as sci-fi is the presence of imaginary technology. You know, whether it's from an alien civilization or from a future Earth civilization, it's the existence in the plot of imaginary technology. And one thing which I think is important to do with sci-fi science is, where possible, don't contradict the real stuff. Don't contradict what's actually known. But above and beyond that, you can expand on it literally to your heart's content. But the other thing which is important to do is be consistent in whatever it is you've constructed. Whatever it is you've constructed, it does what it does, and that's what it does. And it can't suddenly start doing something else just because it's going to get you here out of a tight spot. You know what I mean? I think it's very important to define the parameters. This is why I've never found Superman a particularly compelling character, because they've never really defined what the limits of his powers are. You know what I mean? You know, he lifts an entire island out of the sea and throws it into space. Is that hard? I don't know. You know what I mean? Can he do that? You know, they've never really established what the parameters of his powers are. So I think it's important if you establish the parameters of the stuff you're inventing. And I think that kind of applies for magic as well.
Yeah.
You know, because I think magic is by definition a slightly more fluid concept, but I think you have to be careful to define the limits of people's powers. Otherwise, otherwise, it becomes what people who don't like fantasy always accuse fantasy of being.
Yeah.
Oh, you're just making it up as you go along. Well, yes and no. You know what I mean?
Well, there's more whimsy. There tends to be more... Well, there tends to be more whimsy in magic, because if you look at something like the Lioness Trilogy by Jack Vance, I mean, his magic is completely fantastical.
Yeah.
And it's implied there are rules, but there's no way you're going to ever understand what the rules are. And a lot of it seems to be driven by, like, clever argument. Like, you argue with the agent that are doing the magic, and it's funny, and weird things can happen. But it is true, yes, because there's a bit of consistency. And can I just point out something that's been really bugging me recently? the proverb is, unnecessary consistency is the hobgoblin of lesser minds,
right?
And that unnecessary is very important.
Yes.
that just really annoys me, that one, because everyone goes, oh, necessity is the hobgoblin.
Consistency is
the hobgoblin of lesser minds. It's unnecessary consistency. Possibly making my point for them at that point.
So going back to characters, or actually going back to the stories.
Is there a difference?
It's sort of a question on both. Have you ever regretted either killing off a character or taking a character down a particular route?
Well, to put it in by regret, I mean, I didn't actually sort of think, oh, shouldn't have killed that person off because they could really do that. But certainly the first, at the end of my first book, when it all kicks off, I do actually kill off a bunch of characters. And I found myself stricken with guilt and remorse having done this, because I'd made these people up. I'd invented them, quite got to like them, and I just killed them. And it was entirely up to me. Could have let him off, you know, plot might still have worked if I let him off. And I was literally just paralysed. I had to email Neil Gaiman. I'm a Neil, I've just killed a bunch of them. I'm weeping. Yes, that's entirely as it should be, said Neil. You know, and so, yeah, not regret in the technical sense, but in the emotional sense. Yeah, I felt horrible about doing that. Had to be done, though.
Well... If my characters, if they allow me to kill them, then they had it coming. The characters that don't want to die will make it very clear to me that they don't want to die and will argue themselves. Although some of them want to die. Some of them go, oh, I'll be a beautiful death. I'll be brilliant. Put me into the death thing. And then I can come back as my own twin. yes. No. All my characters, I either done what they bloody told me they were going to do, or had it coming because the plot demanded. And good riddance.
So, have you ever based any characters on real life people, other than, you know, maybe this guy at Tenswater?
No. I've nicked a few names, which I've been told to stop doing.
Guess why?
Critics. People I don't like. The guy who used to run Waterstones. An area manager from Waterstones who came in and complained, made my life miserable for 2 weeks for no good reason. So I killed
him. Did you use his whole name?
Yeah, his whole name.
Not just his first or his surname.
Yeah, if you're going to do it, I think so. Yeah, if you're going to exact literary revenge, don't drop it.
He wasn't an area manager for Waterstones. I didn't describe him in any way. But I just used his name because I just thought, and it was Moon Over Soho, so they died in a horrible kind of castrate-y way.
Oh, well. Lovely. Okay.
Which was very satisfying.
I've based pretty much all my characters on to at least an extent on people, I put it, which is, you know, probably less detectable because they're nearly all aliens. But I mean, there's the obvious one in book two. There's a 14-year-old scouse teenage sci-fi nerd who is patently the young me, and I've not really made any effort to distance me. It would just be futile to pretend otherwise. But Lubbock, the central character, the adopted father character, I mean, he's there's a lot of me in him because he's just, you know, sort of classic panicky dad in many respects. You know, the fact that he's an alien and his kid's human is slightly incidental. He's just your archetypal panic, well-meaning but slightly rubbish dad, you know. The fact that my protagonist is a little girl is probably tied up with the fact that I've got daughters rather than sons. If I'd had little boys, then they might be a little boy. I thought it was just quite a nice change, apart from anything else, the protagonist of those two. You know, when we were doing that list of the lost baby, they're all male, you know what I mean? And I don't think that one of those stories has been based around a female baby before. Terra certainly looks, in my mind, quite a bit like my eldest daughter, Greta, but Terra's mate, Futhfuth, is entirely based on my eldest daughter, Greta. She's completely just hyper-intelligent freak in nature with a big, round, smiley face and a goblin, and it just never stops. That Greta narrates her. I mean, I'm talk a lot, but she just, I mean, she started talking at the age of 9 months and hasn't paused. And she just narrates her entire existence. She has no internal monologue. If it goes through, it comes out there. And so there's a bit at the end of the first book when Futhfuth becomes temporarily neurologically incapable of shutting up. And that was definitely my little daughter. Greta knows that Futhfuth is entirely based on her. She thinks it's brilliant. But yeah, so there's all kinds of various people I know who find their way into the thing. I don't know if it's necessary. I don't know to what extent it would be possible to create a character ex nihilo. I think everything is based on everything we see around us. You know,
yeah,
it's just a question of how you remix it, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's just a question of how you mix it up.
So be careful when you're talking to writers. That's my motto.
Yeah.
Really careful, especially any childhood anecdotes. We go, that's like candy.
In it goes. Yeah, that's good.
I'll have that, thank you. That's not copyright. It's not copyright unless it's a completed work.
So you've both written in different media. You've written for Casualty, Doctor Who and books. So what's the difference in writing for the different media, and which do you prefer? Or are there bits of one that you like better than
another? There's the kind of formal differences between writing in different media, and then there's the number of Gibbons involved.
Okay.
And you see, in when you write for novels, there's far fewer Gibbons than if you write...
You're saying Givens or Gibbons?
Gibbons.
Right, yeah.
Gibbons. You know what I mean by Gibbons. If I say... producer Gibbons.
Oh right, okay, fair enough. Gibbons, right, yes.
Other people having...
You were saying Gibbons, I thought I was mishearing you.
No, I call them Gibbons because I always... actually it's wrong because they probably should be something else, but I always imagine them showing their buttocks. They spend a lot of time in meetings hooting and showing each other their buttocks. And they really have no talent and no function in the creative process whatsoever, except to just hoot and show their buttocks and... on you occasionally, yeah,
and justify their existence by screwing up other people's stuff.
Exactly, yeah. And you get, and the thing is that you know, the more concentrated the money there is, the more Gibbons you get. So like for example, in gaming, in games, there are vast amounts of Gibbons because gaming is a hugely expensive thing now. So you get my friend who writes for games, he just comes back with the most horrendous stories that put a lot of my TV experiences into perspective. But then in TV you get a lot because it's expensive, in film you get a lot. But as you get down to publishing, you know, the money gets less and less and less, and there's less Gibbony, there's much less Gibbon. Although you always get, the Gibbon will always be with us, saith Jesus Christ, I think, on the Sermon on the Mount.
My other writing has been altogether less high profile than this. I mean, obviously, I write all my stuff on the radio, and above me on the songs. You know, I write the, you know, if I'm doing extended format stuff like this thing I did about the Beatles, I wrote all of that. And I'm doing three more of those in the new year. I'm doing an Elvis one, a Bowie one, and a Dylan one, so I'm having to write all of that. I think what is more satisfying about the books, though, is their sense of permanence. What drives you a bit nuts about writing for a kind of a weekly turnover thing like the Now Show is, you're aware that however much time and effort you put into this, and I do put a lot of time and effort into some of that stuff, it's going to get played on Friday, repeated on Saturday, and then it's going to drift off into space. And the thing I like,
usually repeated on YouTube.
Yeah. Although, see, somebody's harvesting all my songs for YouTube, and it's not my mum, which is unusual because that is entirely the kind of thing she'd do if she had any idea what YouTube was or how it worked. actually, no, she does know what YouTube is, but she doesn't know how it works.
Vision of the 2030s. This is when the mums do.
Oh no. The last time I was at my parents' house, I installed their Wi-Fi. It really is the 21st century, folks. So that's the thing which is most pleasing about the books. It's not necessarily about the process. I know what you mean about this. You see, I'm quite lucky that in radio they tend to leave you the hell alone as well.
Because
there's no money involved. It's the trouble is, there really isn't. You know, not the kind of radio I do. God, it's buttons. But people are, you know, very, very disappointed when they discover how much money I don't make. but people do have this lovely idea that it's 1976, and if you're regularly appearing on any kind of broadcast media, you're driving around in a Bentley. It's like, no, really not. So they tell me. I'm quite lucky in that I'm generally left to my own devices again, because it's when suddenly you're in a TV show that's costing like 150 grand an ep, then everybody wants to cover all the bases. Everybody wants to make sure, oh, we're doing this right there. Or you're showing a movie which is going to be cost $120 million. This is a conversation we're having on the way here. Is that how far down your heart sinks during the opening credits of a movie as the more screenwriting credits come up? You're just like, you know, screenplay by three guys plus two guys, story by four guys plus three guys, based on an original idea by two guys from the novel by one. This is going to be a car crash. You know, this has been rewritten something like 27 times. There's going to be no actual story left in it at all. So that's one of the things I'm quite fortunate. I don't really get into Fearbus, but the difference between me with everything else I write in the books is I do like the feeling of permanence that you get with the books. You know, that it's a thing now. It's a thing which is sitting on people's shelves, and it's going to exist in some form or another for the foreseeable future. It
never gets old.
And that people are still discovering. That's what I like, you know. I'm having written the two so far, but people are still finding the first one, you know, and people are still tweeting me and say, oh, just finished the first one, and I get to say, read the second one, you know.
That disparaging thing where they found, I found you off work, I read it in a charity shop which I bought. Buy a new one, you
type. I don't think they printed enough of mine to them end up in charity shops, that they were all quite cherished by whoever actually managed to get hold of one.
To answer that question, does anyone want the technical answer to that question as well? Because that was quite fun, and the technical question is actually quite boring. No. Okay.
So you mentioned Douglas Adams,
yeah,
and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which, yep, if you read Terror, there is. You can see there is
Douglas was in the room. Yeah, I mean they are very, very different kinds of narratives. In as much as
the Hitchhiker's that barn,
what's that? That's what I want to know. The Hitchhiker's books are like these sort of freewheeling stream of consciousness satires that kind of operate within a sci-fi framework. These are more just kind of straightforward science fiction stories with a lot of jokes in.
But they do have that same charm.
Oh, that's very nice of you. Thank you.
Which there's the same charm in both of them, which is actually a little bit quieter and warmer than, say, some cynical of your other stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like to think I've got different dimensions to me. You know what I mean? And part of the thing I've really liked about having the books out is maybe being thought of in a slightly different way to, you know, than that guy who writes the rude songs. You know, it's quite nice to be, you know, it's nice to have hidden depths, and it's even nicer to show them. You know, and so I've quite enjoyed that. But I'll admit that, I mean, yeah, it would be foolish to deny that there was an obvious Douglas Adams, and certainly the beginning of the first one, there's a very obvious Roald Dahl influence. I mean, kind of the idea for the first one was almost like, you know, what if Roald Dahl wrote a Douglas Adams book or vice versa? You know, that was kind of very much in my mind. You know, the first one begins very much as a Roald Dahl book, the first couple of chapters, and then it kind of tonally progresses away from that, which was the idea anyway. But I'll admit, certainly in just in use of language, or certainly Douglas had an amazing way with made up alien names for stuff. And, you know, in the first book, there's the legendary planet Gagra-Sem-Gagra that that orbited the giant red star Thum. Now, I'm sorry, but you don't have a planet called Gagra-Sem-Gagra orbiting a giant red star called Thum and not have Douglas Adams somewhere in the back of your mind. There's a weapon in the second one called a Frastic Jalga Blast Tube. And I'm sorry, but, you know, that is a... I'll admit, right, yeah, that's a Douglas word right there. Frastic Jalga Blast Tube. I remember thinking that actually in the early days of the new Doctor Who. There's a lot of fairly obvious Douglas Adams word in it. The thing that lives in the ceiling that orders Simon Pegg about was called the Grand Jagrafess of the Holy Hadrajassic Maxorodonfo. And I remember thinking, particularly the word Hadrajassic is a Douglas word, isn't it? It just really is. It's up there with, you know, the Jatravartids and the Belcerobons, you know what I mean? Yeah, Douglas had a great, great thing with made-up alien words. So, I mean, there's... But like I say, I think they are a very different kind of book. You know, I think they're not... You know, my books are altogether more straightforward in terms of narrative. They are, but they've got jokes in. But I think everything I do always will. So one of the funny things about the books is some of them reviewed them as comedy sci-fi books, which kind of wasn't really what I had in mind. They're kind of sci-fi books with jokes in. I don't mind it, but people, as long as people are reviewed and viewing it, I don't even care what they call them. You know what I mean? But I think that they're more kind of sci-fi with a sense, and certainly the end of the first one goes really bleak. You know what I mean? It goes, and I was hoping that wasn't going to be too jarring, but people seem to be okay with it. That basically it all kicks off the end of the first one, and you know,
well,
kind of, you
the
know,
second one. So you know,
the second one starts bleak and actually gets bleaker. But there's this sort of more, well, there's this kind of mordant sense of humour that runs the whole thing. But I think there will be an ever.
Take the man away from the Mersey.
Very possibly. I don't think I would be capable of writing anything which had no humorous content whatsoever. I remember hearing an interview with John Hillcoat on Radio 2 just after the movie, because he directed the movie of The Road.
Yeah.
And that was, the question was, you know, is this a depressing film or a film about depressing stuff? And over the course of the conversation, that, well, obviously it's fairly grim. I mean, you know, you couldn't write a knockabout farce about the slow agonizing death of the planet Earth. And I thought, yeah, you could. Yeah. yeah, you could. You really could. And in fact, I think maybe I will. You know what I mean? You could write a hilarious comedy about the slow agonizing
death. Robert Rankin probably has.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, you know, Milligan did. He did The Best Sitting Room. That was basically a sort of a bizarre, surreal comedy about the slow agonizing death of the planet Earth. You know, yeah, you could. You could write. You can be funny about anything. I mean, some things are easier to be funny about than others. But, you know, this is a conversation we have.
Sometimes if you're going to talk about something, you actually better be funny because no one else is going to read it.
Yeah, exactly. But this is a conversation we have all the time in comedy is, you know, are any subjects completely off limits? Are there certain things that you just cannot crack jokes about? And I think the general consensus is nothing is entirely technically off limits, but some things are so difficult to make funny, it's probably not worth bothering.
Yes.
You know, because
the price of failure is high.
Yeah, exactly. You'll just upset everybody and make a
of yourself if you fail. So some things are just probably not worth trying to be funny about. But everything is possible to be funny about.
Because comedy is terribly, terribly brave, you see. Comedy, because there is no heroic failure in comedy.
No, there's only failure.
There's only failure. That's the thing I've always admired about people who do comedy is that, you know, it either works or it isn't. It's either funny. The audience either laughs or they don't.
It gets back to your Gibbons thing. Is the only time I've ever had any sort of gibboning at me is when I've got into arguments with radio producers about how to land a joke. And I'm like, there are all kinds of things you can tell me about. You can't tell me a damn thing about how to land a joke.
Yes.
You know, I've been doing this 4 or 5 nights a week for 20 years, and we don't need, if we do something that just doesn't work in a live comedy environment, we don't need for the Rajars to come in. We don't need to wait for the audience appreciation index. We don't need to see what Gillian Reynolds said about it in the Telegraph. You know what I mean? If we do something that didn't work, oh, we know that didn't work. You know, we get to find out right now that just didn't work. You know what I mean? So it's
in the most humiliating way possible.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The most vivid way, but nope, that wasn't funny. That thing I said that was supposed to be funny, it really wasn't.
Yeah,
was
it fell completely flat.
Exactly. You know, it's the most abject technical failure possible in art.
You can actually define a comedian as somebody who's willing to get up after someone's just slapped them in the face, after they've fallen flat on their face.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't do comedy. I mean, straight comedy in front of an audience, because that's embarrassing. And painful, and I don't have enough. Already have quite a lot of humiliation in my life without having to add that to the mix. You know, go out. I want to be humiliated, please.
Sci-Fi and Fantasy Sunday was a Burst.co.uk production for Radio Wimborne. It was recorded at the Allendale Centre on the 9th of November 2014, and was produced by Tom Harrison, Lindsay Wu, Oliver Morris, and Michael Dale.